Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm George Shultz, former U.S. Secretary of State, and your chair for tonight's program. Tonight's program is part of the Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, James A. Baker III, former U.S. Secretary of State under President George H.W. Bush. Now let me add my own special words of introduction. What can you say about Jim Baker that makes him outstanding in particular? Well, he has 18 grandchildren and a terrific wife. What more do I need to say? Nothing. Of course, he's held many important positions, and I'll just talk about some of the things he's done. As Secretary of State, he did a marvelous job of managing the end game of the Cold War, bringing it all down with no bloodshed. It was a terrific piece of work. He managed to convene a conference in Madrid that managed to get the parties in the Middle East together in a way that hadn't been done before, and you're tempted to say will never happen since. But at any rate, that was terrific. And then, of course, there was the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein was kicked out of Kuwait very clearly and definitely. That was done adroitly from a diplomatic standpoint with UN approval from the US Congress. And amazingly, Jim was able to go around and get all the other countries who had a stake to help pay for it. And that is the kind of thing you'd expect from somebody who is a former Secretary of the Treasury, because he has that kind of problem on his mind. But when he was Secretary of Treasury, he managed to negotiate the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement. He managed to work out a currency arrangement that got things into better alignment, particularly between the dollar and the yen. And then, I think, especially remarkable and of tremendous long-term importance was the bipartisan 1986 Tax Reform Act. This act, you remember, stripped out a lot of preferences, got the high top marginal rate down to 28%. It was a really remarkable piece of work, and to my way of thinking is the unsung hero of the prosperity that we've had after that. He was chief of staff in the White House for Ronald Reagan, ran a very tight ship. He went to Princeton, got his law degree at the University of Texas in Austin, practiced law. Marine, good Marine Corps guy. And he's written two books that I know of, one on the politics of diplomacy, and the other has a kind of a tricky title. It says, Work Hard, Study, and Keep Out of Politics. So he has many honors. I think the one, of course, that I want to particularly mention is the Medal of Freedom, Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor our nation can grant. So it's a special privilege and pleasure for me to introduce to this wonderful Commonwealth Club audience my longtime friend, Jim Baker.
Thank you very much, George, for that generous introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here with you this afternoon. And it's really a special pleasure for me to share this stage with George Shultz, because I've always had the greatest respect for not only his formidable intellect, but his fierce sense of duty. As a matter of fact, in the first book I wrote, the one that he mentioned, The Politics of Diplomacy, about my 4 years as Secretary of State, I said that George Shultz was my role model when we served together in President Reagan's cabinet, and even later when I became Secretary of State. And that's not surprising, perhaps, when you consider that our lives have been remarkably parallel. We both went to Princeton. We both were Marines. We both are Marines. We both are Republicans, and we both were Secretaries of the Treasury and Secretary of State, so he was my role model. And I want to tell you something, George. For me, you continue to serve as a role model. It's been a while since we were in public office, but I pick up periodicals all the time where we see George Shultz unflaggingly continuing his efforts to make this world of ours more secure and more prosperous. As a matter of fact, and I'm going to mention a little bit more of this later on, he is one of the co-sponsors, co-authors of an initiative to stem weapons nuclear proliferation. He's always out there writing and arguing for free trade. And sad to say, one of the things that I think has happened that's distressing to me and I think bad for our country is that the consensus for free trade is gone. It used to be that the left side of the Democratic Party and the right side of the Republican Party were right together on that. They both supported free trade. It's all gone now. And George, let me therefore take this moment to thank you and for your friendship to me. You mentioned the fact that we were friends. Your friendship means a lot to me. But more importantly, I want to thank you for your dedication to our country. Here's a man, ladies and gentlemen, who is a true patriot and one of our nation's most distinguished public servants. And it's a real pleasure for me to share the stage with George Shultz. Now, George mentioned the title of my second book, Work Hard, Study, and Keep Out of Politics. That title is facetious, and it was given that I gave it the title because that was what my grandfather used to say to the young lawyers that came to work for our law firm in Houston, Texas. He said, if you want to be a good lawyer, work hard, study, and keep out of politics. Well, that was the mantra in our family. I followed that advice for the first 40 years of my life. It was only after I lost a wife to cancer when she was only 38 years of age that I had a life-changing experience. I had a good friend in Houston at the time, my tennis doubles partner, who came to me and he said, you know, Bake, he said, you got to take your mind off your grief. How about helping me run for the Senate? And I said, well, George, I said, that's a great idea, except for two things. Number one, I don't know anything about politics. I've been following my grandfather's advice. And number two, I'm a Democrat. He said, well, we can take care of that latter problem. And we did. And to shorten the story, one thing led to another. I ended up getting into politics in a big way. I ended up, as a matter of fact, just 7 years after converting to the Republican Party, I found myself running an incumbent Republican president's campaign for President Gerry Ford. We lost in a really narrow race. Most people don't remember how close that was. 10,000 votes separated Ford and Carter. You turn 10,000 votes around in Ohio and Hawaii, and Ford would have been elected, and Carter would never have been president. And I remember thinking to myself at 3 o'clock in the morning when it was obvious that we had just lost in a squeaker, my goodness, this is so bizarre. I thought to myself, here you were 7 years ago, a Republican lawyer, Democratic lawyer in Houston, Texas, and now you've run a presidential campaign for an incumbent Republican president in what is clearly going to be the closest presidential election of your lifetime. Well, that didn't exactly hold up But anyway, one thing led to another, and after we lost that narrow race with Ford, I came back to Texas, and I thought, you know, I've practiced law for 17 years. I'm going to try my hand at this politics. So I filed to run for statewide office, and that was a day back there that long ago when Texas was every bit as Democratic as it is today Republican. Republicans hadn't won statewide in Texas since Reconstruction. But nevertheless, there I was out there campaigning for statewide office, and I never will forget one hot summer day in some little town in Texas, maybe up in the Panhandle, Lubbock or somewhere, and I see a group of people standing at a shopping center. I go over to give them some campaign literature, Now, bear in mind, I've had a lot of face time on national television as Ford's national chairman. And I walk up to this guy, and I stick out my hand to introduce myself to him, and before I can say a word, he looks at me and says, "Say, did anybody ever tell you you look like Jim Baker?" And I said, "Yes, sir, often." He never batted an eyelash. He said, "Doesn't it piss you off?" Well, that's the first clue I had that I might not win that race. And I didn't win it, and it's a good thing. Otherwise, I would never have had the opportunity to go to Washington and work with the likes of George Shultz. I've been asked to speak to you tonight on the ethical imperative of America's involvement on the world stage. And at one level, that's very simple. It's an easy topic to answer. So simple, I think, that sometimes we overlook it. This imperative derives from the duty of our government to advance the security and the prosperity of the American people. If you look at the preamble of the Constitution, it pretty much sums it up when it says that the United States will provide for the common defense and will promote the general welfare. So achieving these goals is, after all, a constitutional obligation of our government, and it is therefore an ethical imperative for democratically elected leaders. That was true when the Constitution was drafted. It was true during the 20th century when three great expansionist powers, Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union, threatened world peace. And it is true today as American security is challenged by the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, the rise of rogue states, and the spread of transnational threats like terrorism. Quite simply, responding to these challenges is impossible without international engagement. So it is an imperative, and I think an ethical one, that America remain engaged on the world stage as a matter of security. So, too, is the obligation to enhance the prosperity of the American people. We've gained a lot since World War II, we Americans, by the liberalization of trade and investment that's taken place over that period. But economic globalization didn't just happen. It was aided at every step of the way. It was aided by international institutions, by formal agreements, and by some informal agreements. And because of them, our citizens enjoy more abundant lives today. Surely, if you look at the recent financial crisis and the attendant economic downturn that's resulted, that provides conclusive evidence of, first, I think, the inextricably linked nature of the global economy, and second, the imperative of that international engagement. It appears, thank God, that we've avoided another Great Depression, a second Great Depression, notwithstanding how bad things may have gotten and may, to some extent, still be. This is in large part, I think, to joint action that was taken by a number of countries on monetary and fiscal policy. So in short, ladies and gentlemen, the security and the prosperity of our citizens are dependent upon factors that are outside the borders of the United States. And advancing these interests demands, I think, that our government engage on the international stage. What I'm really saying is we need the world. And I would submit that the world also needs us. And that's because, by and large, and there are exceptions, but by and large, America's global leadership has been for the betterment of mankind. Since 1945, we have helped avoid another catastrophic world war. As I said earlier, fought three wars in that century and won them all. Our efforts to spread democracy and free markets in the face of totalitarianism have helped untold millions of people free themselves from tyranny and rise from poverty. We contributed mightily to a peaceful end of the Cold War, a war that, but for America's leading role, could have ended with a bang instead of with a whimper. We've also been, on balance, a force for stability in the world. On balance, there are exceptions, helping to foster closer relations between once deadly enemies in regions such as Western Europe and the Middle East. By any standard, I think the United States still enjoys a uniquely preeminent place in world affairs. Now, we're not omnipotent, but compared, if you compare us to earlier great powers, if you compare us to ancient Rome, to Napoleonic France, to Britain at her peak just prior to World War II, we possess, I think, immense advantages over potential rivals. Does this mean we should be a policeman to the world or its nanny? No, of course not. We should be neither. And even our power has its limits, and we've seen some of that in recent years. Indeed, if you have too ambitious a foreign policy, you risk strategic overreach. And that could undermine American domestic support for international engagement generally. I think spring of 2010 is a very appropriate time to talk about this issue, because today America's uniquely preeminent position in world affairs is being questioned after serving as the global leader in the aftermath of the Cold War, a period that some referred to as a unipolar period. There is an increasing suspicion today that America's best days are in the rearview mirror. I happen not to share that bleak assessment, and I would bet that George Shultz doesn't either. American power is perhaps most obvious in the military arena. Our services represent the best armed, the best trained, and the best led military in the world, and no other countries today can even begin to approach that capability. Nor will they be able to for decades to come. Meanwhile, despite the economic tsunami that swept the world last year, the United States remains an economic powerhouse. I'm going to talk in a moment about some of our serious economic problems, but we do remain an economic powerhouse. Our output represents almost a quarter today of total world GDP. In addition, we wield immense diplomatic influence in the global arena. The United States enjoys strong and durable bilateral relationships with a host of friendly countries, and we also play a leadership role in many international institutions, such as the United Nations, NATO, WTO, and the IMF. And last but certainly not least, we represent a paradigm, an ideology, if you will, that I call free market democracy, that is without a serious global rival. That model is clearly not triumphant everywhere today. There's some relatively substantial backsliding on it in South America particularly. But the recent financial crisis has also tarnished its image. But the general trend over recent decades, I think, has unmistakably been in the direction of democracy and free markets. In short, ladies and gentlemen, there is no country or group of countries that can challenge our international preeminence today. Now, will that share of global influence decline in future decades? Almost certainly it will. But in my view, this is really less a matter of us falling behind than of other countries catching up. And they are catching up largely because decades-long American efforts to liberalize trade and investment have been working. Countries like India and China are modernizing their economies, and they're opening up them up to foreign trade and investment. And this really should be received as good news by us and not as bad news. But neither China nor India nor any other country comes close to the United States today in its total amount of either hard power or soft power. And they can't be expected to in the near to mid-future. Now, having said that, here comes the however, and it's a big however. Our preeminence faces possible decline, perhaps a very fast and abrupt decline, if we don't find a way to correct our financial and economic imbalances. Our economic strength not only permits us to project force and exert influence around the world, it also serves as an example to the world of the advantages of free market democracy. But if the United States is to maintain the trust and confidence of other countries, sooner or later we're going to have to get our economic house in order. First and foremost, to me, that means defusing that big ticking debt bomb that's out there. The United States currently has a debt that totals 93% of its gross domestic product. For the next 3 years, that level will hover at around 100% of gross domestic product. Our gross domestic product today is somewhere in the, between $14 and $15 trillion. 100% of debt to GDP is a ratio that has not existed in this country since the end of World War II. We built it up in order to fight and win World War II. So this is clearly not sustainable. It's not sustainable, particularly in light of projected increases in entitlement programs like Social Security and especially Medicare. And it's not sustainable also given the fact that it doesn't yet include whatever additional costs are going to be incurred as a consequence of reforming health care. So for now, it's my view that our current debt problems, for now, and I don't know how long now is, but for now, our current debt problems alone will not cause our economy to falter. Today, most people around the world trust that the United States is going to get its economic house in order, and they expect us to solve our problems. Our federal government is still borrowing money at very advantageous rates, but that trust is not set in stone. As we move forward, investors will, quite understandably, continually reevaluate whether the United States remains the safest place for their money. Unless we defuse that debt bomb, our entire economy will suffer, and so will our standing around the world. And so, by the way, will the standard of living of you, the American people. There's another related issue that could undermine our global leadership, and when I mention that, I'm talking now about the political dysfunction in Washington, D.C. And I might say the same thing is true with respect to many of the states, sadly, I think California among them. But this political dysfunction is making it very hard for our leaders to build consensus for pragmatic solutions. Now, I've been around politics long enough to know that it is indeed a blood sport. As a matter of fact, after the Florida recount in the presidential election of 2000, George sent me a tie that says, it says on the tie, democracy is not a spectator sport. And George had it right years ago, I think, when he said, nothing ever gets settled in this Washington. He said, it's a seething, debating society in which the debate never stops. Today, however, I'm sure that George will agree with me that the political infighting is out of control. The debating teams of our era have morphed into partisan execution squads. This paralysis at home really does risk undermining U.S. leadership abroad. And that leadership will be required if we are to address the many challenges confronting us in the international arena. And I want to mention just two of those as I move toward a conclusion here. The first is the world's economic meltdown. Last year marked the first year since World War II that global economic output declined. It shrank 1% in 2009, compared with average annual increases of 3.5% since 1946. Meanwhile, global trade plummeted nearly 25% in 2009. That, ladies and gentlemen, is an historic 60-year decline. Today, we appear to be on a rebound, although I think that rebound may be quite fragile. The world economy still faces major challenges if we are to continue the recovery and prevent future financial problems from swamping that economy. Inflation is a potential problem. I don't see how it's not going to come back. It's got to come back. The fiscal stimulus packages put in place in 2009 required most countries, including ours, to run huge budget deficits. Inflation and interest rates may today be low in many major economies, including the United States. But when economic activity picks up, central banks are going to face the very difficult task of containing inflation without raising interest rates to levels that will snuff out the recovery. Meanwhile, countries need to work together to regulate or re-regulate financial markets. Lending institutions, in my view, must be required to keep some percentage of debt obligations they create. In other words, lending institutions should have to keep some skin in the game. They ought not to be able to loan to this block of wood here, a loan that's a really bad loan, and then throw it into the financial system and not worry about it anymore. And they must maintain more conservative capital requirements. Esoteric and opaque derivative products like credit default swaps need better oversight. Transparency here is going to be essential. In short, we got to do these things. I'm a conservative Republican, as is George, and I would submit to you and we're former Republican Treasury Secretaries that we both see a need here to re-regulate in order to avoid a repeat of what has just occurred. But in so doing, I would also suggest that we probably both agree on this too, that we're careful to not cross the fine line between regulation and strangulation. Too much regulation can strangle the economy. We must address the too big to fail problem. How we do that, I'm not sure. Senator Dodd has just announced a regulatory reform proposal for our financial institutions, and there's some things in there that move in that direction. We should also deal with the imbalance that exists today in the global economy between high savings countries and high consuming countries. China, a high savings country. The United States, a high consuming country. These are the most important cases in point. There needs to be some careful and deliberate and orchestrated correction here. If we are to have credibility, the United States must be prepared to do its part in rebalancing the world economy through reduced public deficits and higher private savings. Now, all of this is easier said than done. Why is it easier said than done? It's easier said than done because there is absolutely no political will on either side of the aisle to restrain spending. And just raising taxes will never get you there in the absence of some spending restraint, because Congress will spend the new taxes raised, and then they'll spend additional money over and above that. Now, the second global challenge I want to mention is the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Nuclear devastation remains a distinct possibility despite all the efforts we've been making over the past 30, 40, 50 years to prevent it. Although the total number of nuclear weapons in the world is about one-third of the peak number in the 1980s, there are more nuclear states than ever before, with Israel, India, and Pakistan each having an arsenal of 50 to 100 weapons, and evidence that other states, such as North Korea and Iran, are working actively to join the nuclear club. Secretary Shultz and three other highly respected figures in U.S. foreign policy, Bill Perry, Henry Kissinger, and Sam Nunn, have been urging that we adopt the goal of a world free of nuclear weapons. They propose a sharp reduction and eventual elimination of current nuclear forces. And they also call, and it's a great proposal, they also call, by the way, for a much strengthened global anti-proliferation regime that would include both suspending the production of fissile material and phasing out the commercial use of highly enriched uranium. These are very ambitious goals, but they do address the very real risk of letting ourselves drift into a dangerous new era of nuclear rivalry, and they conform to ideals long held by Western publics and leaders alike. Ronald Reagan, we should recall, dreamed of a world without nuclear weapons. And I think his vision should continue to inspire us all. But that vision will not be easily attained, and we must be honest and frank with ourselves about that. It's going to be very, very difficult. It's going to take decades, and it's going to require agreement among countries that are as diverse as Russia, China, India, Pakistan, and Israel. And in my opinion, it really has no chance of being achieved unless three conditions are applied to the effort. And I've talked to George about these three conditions. I'll let him speak for himself. I think he agrees with them. First of all, if you're going to get there, every country with nuclear weapons, that's declared nuclear powers as well as threshold states, those that are about to acquire, the nuclear capability. Declared ones, undeclared ones, and threshold states, all of them have to be included in any nuclear arms reductions. There can be no exceptions. Second, any reductions towards disarmament have to be taken proportionately. Everybody's got to come down at the same rate, percentage-wise, or you won't be able to get that agreement. You won't be able to negotiate the agreements you need to have. And third, because trust is paramount in arms reductions, there has to be an agreed, intrusive inspection and verification regime. Just as Ronald Reagan, in my view, was right to envision a world free of nuclear weapons, he was also correct when he warned, trust but verify. So we need an intrusive inspection regime if you're ever going to get countries to agree to this. But with hard work and patience, we can be hopeful. It can be done. It will not be done without U.S. leadership. And that means leadership by the President of the United States. Now, there are other challenges that will require global responses, and maybe we can talk about those in the Q&A portion of the program, ranging from international terrorism to environmental challenges to the management of regional conflicts that could erupt into global ones. I believe the United States has an ethical imperative to engage on all of these global challenges and other issues in the international arena. But I also believe that our nation's ability to meet that challenge is being threatened. Ironically, it's being threatened more domestically than it is internationally. Our failure to address our fiscal and economic problems and our political dysfunction generally threaten both our ability to exert influence abroad and to sustain support for engagement at home. And George will tell you, as I will, having been Secretary of State, no foreign policy is sustainable that does not command the support of the American people. In the last century alone, ladies and gentlemen, we won three great global conflicts. We created an economy of affluence unparalleled in human history. And we successfully navigated the vast social transformations that began in the 1960s. It would be simply astonishing if such a country could not muster the political fortitude to put its fiscal house in order. As I mentioned at the outset of these remarks, the origins of engagement's ethical imperative lie in the duty of our government to its citizens. But as citizens, I would suggest to you that we also have to do our part. Polls show broad public disenchantment with the paralysis of our political system. Americans today expect more, deserve more, and therefore they should demand more. As citizens, we also have an ethical imperative. We have an imperative to understand more about issues, foreign and domestic, through civic-minded fora such as this one right here at the Commonwealth Club. We have an ethical imperative to learn to see through the fog of partisan political rhetoric and focus on the really important questions that confront us as a nation. And we have an ethical imperative to vote for candidates who are not afraid to spend their political chits and use their political power to do what has to be done to keep this wonderful country of ours where it belongs, right up at the very top. Thank you very much. I'll be delighted to respond to your questions.
Our thanks to James A. Baker III, former U.S. Secretary of State, for his remarks this evening. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and I will be moderating tonight's audience question period. Secretary Baker, we have many questions, so let's begin. You've been inside the White House as a chief of staff and obviously very high positions in other administrations. If you were in Washington today, and you mentioned the word political dysfunction in Washington, how does the White House, how would you manage this kind of political dysfunction, and do you see any type of solution to what's happening in Washington today?
Well, the one solution in a democracy such as ours for these kind of problems are elections. And, of course, we will always have another election coming around the corner. And it may be that we can move past some of this with future elections. The problem is the country is so evenly divided. And politics in Washington has become very ugly. It's a zero-sum game now. And I must say that to some extent, present company excluded, meaning you, the press plays a little role in this because controversy sells and accommodation really doesn't sell as well. And so there's always a rush for the story that's about the battling that's going on. And part of that, Robert, is the fact that the outlets have proliferated so much from the time when George and I were there. Now you have all the cable networks. You've got the Internet. People can throw stuff, blog stuff up there without any responsibility. They can just throw up there whatever they want, and they'll pick it up out there in the ether, and people will run with it. So it gets to be very hard to pursue an accommodative and consensual approach to governing. When I went up there first with Ford in 1975, and George had been up there before that, we used to work across the aisle. We, you know, you could be adversaries without being enemies. You could disagree agreeably. You can't seem to do that anymore in Washington, and that's very sad. Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill never saw two. They didn't have one policy agreement on anything. They saw everything differently, but at the end of the day, they would get together and have a drink and tell Irish jokes and go about the business of the next day. It doesn't happen anymore. It's too bad. It really is sad. I will say this, and this is not a partisan comment. I'm out of politics, and I have respect for the presidency of the United States and for our current president. But I think he made two big mistakes. Number one, he did not prioritize his initiatives. He took a whole bunch of them. I think Jimmy Carter made this mistake. George will tell you, well, that's not George, he wasn't there. George came in 82. But when we first started with the Reagan-Bush administration in 81, we focused with singular, laser-like focus on our economic program. We wouldn't even talk about some issues that were off of the mark. And that was the one thing we put up there. And that was the only reason I think we were able to bring across Democrats to support our program. The other reason was we set up our own program. I think President Obama has made a good faith mistake by subcontracting to the leadership in the House and Senate his stimulus program, his health care program, and his cap and trade environmental program. And they've crafted it along the lines of their philosophical views, but those views are not as much in the mainstream as it would have been, and I think, if he'd sent up his own bill. And then he could have gone to Republicans. There would have been some Republicans who he could have gone to and say, what do you need changed in this bill? So you can go home to your district or your state and say, look what I got changed in the president's health care bill or cap and trade bill. That's what we did with Reagan in 81. And I think that's the way you go about bipartisanship. It's sad that we don't have it, and I won't argue with you that Republicans now are not going to, they're not cooperating. To some extent, if he had sent his own bill up there, maybe he would have been able to pull some of them across. But I'm not trying to cast blame. There's fault on both sides for the political dysfunction of our country.
In politics, and especially foreign policy, does the end justify the means? What is the ethical imperative when the interests of the U.S. are not the best interest of another nation? Our history is ripe with such difficult situations. And is realpolitik an ethical foreign policy?
Well, it is. In my view, it's an ethical foreign policy because it's the only policy that you can follow that will bring along the American people. And in a democracy such as ours, it is the will of the American people that's the final arbiter of our foreign policy. This is a tough statement I'm about to make, and you all, many of you will disagree with it, but I happen to believe it's true. You can't practice foreign policy solely according to the principles of Mother Teresa. Yes, you have to have principles and values in the formulation and implementation of your foreign policy. But if you don't have a significant national interest involved as well, sooner or later, particularly when the body bags start coming home, you will lose the American people. And when you lose the American people, you've lost the policy.
But the American people will not send their sons and daughters and husbands and wives over to a foreign land to bleed and die just for a principle. There needs to be some nexus or connection or interest of the United States in that policy that you can talk about in advance. Now, that's not to say that principles and values aren't really important in formulating and implementing our policy. They are. But you have to have the proper mix of principles and values on the one hand and national interest on the other.
When you became chief of staff, when you entered the White House, is there information you're given that really changes perceptions you have, that turns you around? Are you surprised by the access and availability of information when someone like you enters the White House?
The access to information? Yes, you get the very best. You get complete access to all the information that our country has. You have what's called, and particularly as Secretary of State, but as White House Chief of Staff also. I attended all of the meetings of the National Security Council. You're in every meeting that the president is in. So you may be, one thing about being Chief of Staff, though, that people need to remember, you may be the second most powerful person in Washington, D.C., but you're only staff. And when you forget that, you get in trouble. And the chiefs of staff who haven't succeeded are chiefs of staff who saw themselves as principals. Nobody voted for you. Nobody elected you to anything. Any power you have is strictly vicarious from the president, and you better not ever forget that or you won't succeed as chief of staff.
Do you recall being really surprised by the level of information, and what I'm trying to get at is that it really changed the perception you have, because the information that generally is received by the public or even a candidate ratchets up once you're inside the Oval Office?
You get a lot more information from the standpoint of security, and you get a lot more security information. And, of course, you're privy to a lot of things that go on that are secret, but that are, I think, still in the national interest. I mean, we do things called covert action, where the president will issue a finding for a secret operation in some country or another. It may be to rescue a U.S. citizen somewhere. It may be something else. It may be to bring down a government that's hostile to the United States. And so you're privy to all of that if you're chief of staff in the White House.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is James A. Baker III, former U.S. Secretary of State under the first President Bush, and we are discussing the direction of U.S. foreign policy. The question, or the issue that got the most questions tonight was, no surprise, Israel. In the current dispute now with the Obama administration, when you were Secretary of State, you had issues with the Israelis and over their foreign policy and issues with settlements. What has changed on the ground today, if anything, and what advice would you have for the current administration on how to deal with this issue?
Well, the difficulty of negotiating peace between Arabs and Israelis is, I think, perhaps even more difficult today than it was maybe in our day, although it was plenty difficult then. And part of that difficulty arises from the fact that there are facts that have been created on the ground by way of settlements. As a matter of background, you should know that every administration, every U.S. administration since the formation of the State of Israel, Republican or Democratic, has been opposed to the building of settlements. The reason they're opposed to it is because the only real basis for finding a way to peace between Arabs and Israelis are UN resolutions 242 and 338, which call for the exchange of land for peace. And if you go out and settle on a piece of land and build settlements and buildings, you foreclose the possibility of exchanging that land for peace. It's creating facts on the ground. Now, that doesn't mean you can't keep some of those settlements and give other land elsewhere to the Palestinians. But settlements, depending on which administration you're talking about, have been characterized either as the settlement activity of the State of Israel characterized either as illegal or as an obstacle to peace. I think when George and I were secretaries, they were deemed to be obstacles to peace, and we opposed them. People are fond of saying that it was the George H.W. Bush administration that finally used its economic leverage against Israel to to make its point about settlements. That's not exactly true. What we did was we did not tamper with any of the normal assistance that the United States gives Israel every year. And we give them quite a bit. The American taxpayer gives every Israeli man, woman, and child quite a bit of money every year. If you add it all up, if you add up all the money that we give to Israel, it's quite substantial. When we had our difficulties with the settlement problem in Israel, the Israeli Prime Minister came to us and he said, in addition to the $3 or $4 billion a year you give us, we want an additional $10 billion in loan guarantees. And we said, well, look, we can't do that. We're trying to get this Madrid conference together. We can't do that unless you're willing to pay some respect to the American policy position on settlements and respect our position on that. And they said, well, we'll get it from the Congress. We'll just get it from the Congress, and, you know, don't worry about it. We'll go up there and get it. And we said, well, fine, we'll see you on the Hill. And we did. And they didn't get it. And that's the thing that people talk about a lot. But that was not a case of our taking the regular funding that we give Israel every year and somehow cutting that back. It was an extra $10 billion that the Israelis wanted. At the same time, they said, we will not respect your position on settlements. Let me mention a couple of axioms about this conflict, if I can. I've already told you that the only solution is land for peace, 242 and 338. You have to have a political process underway, or there'll be violence on the ground. That's been proven in the Arab-Israeli conflict. And there's a catch-22 here, too. Israel will really never enjoy security until she negotiates a secure peace with her Arab neighbors. And the Palestinians will never enjoy an independent state living alongside Israel in peace until Israel enjoys security. So it's a catch-22. No American administration will ever, ever not be there for Israel. They will always. Israel is our strong ally. We will always be there for her, particularly from the standpoint of her security. That does not mean that we do not have our own interests in the region, stability. That does not mean that we do not believe, Democrat and Republican alike, that the best way for Israel to achieve her security is to negotiate a peace with her neighbors. She's negotiated peace with Egypt and with Jordan. And those are the two borders that are most secure for her today. Not a unilateral withdrawal from territory, but a negotiated peace, a negotiated secure peace. The problem has been the hardliners on both sides. You see some of that today in this current contretemps between the Israeli government and the United States government, where the Vice President of the United States goes over there on a mission to reassert our commitment to the security of Israel, and he's met with the announcement of a settlement for 1,600 homes or something like that. Now, that's not something unusual. Every time I went to Israel before I put the Madrid Peace Conference together, I was met with an announcement of a new settlement. But it really isn't the right thing to do. That's not the right thing for Israel to do to its patron, to the country that does as much as we do. And that's why you see the administration today calling it an insult and calling it and condemning it and using terms like that. So it's a difference of opinion. It's a difference of opinion between friends. I don't think it's going to result in a complete rupture of the relationship. But it's not something that friends should do to friends.
I think we'll stay in the neighborhood.
What?
We'll stay in the neighborhood, Middle East. Moving to Iraq, I mean, your report, I think, written in the end of 2004.
Yeah. No, it was written in 2007.
In hindsight, well, it's only 2 years, but what do you think with the situation in Iraq now? The surge seems to have worked on one level. Mm-hmm. Based on what's happened on the ground, have you changed any of your opinions in that? Or looking forward, what do we see?
Well, I think that that to some extent the jury is still out on Iraq. The surge certainly did improve things significantly, and now we see the Iraqis participating in the exercise of democracy. The key is going to be whether or not they can negotiate a government. The ethnic tensions and differences are still there, but at least now we have hope that we're going to be able to bring our troops home at the end of all combat troops are supposed to be out, I believe, at the end of August, and then all U.S. forces out by the end of 2011. And hopefully we're going to be able to meet those deadlines, and that Iraq will be able to cobble together a government, and they'll be able to govern. They'll somehow find a way to issue that oil law that they need to do for the sharing of those resources and things like that. So the situation in Iraq is much improved, but it's still a little bit dicey. And so I think the key is whether or not they're going to be able to create a government. The election was quite close. I used to get calls from foreign ministers foreign ministers and prime ministers that I had worked with when I was Secretary of State, when I was in Florida for those 37 days, said, "What's the matter with your country? You can't even run an election? What's going on there?" And I said, "Wait a minute, I'll tell you what's happening here." I said, "We're dealing with an extraordinarily emotional event, and we're dealing with it in the right way. And guess what? There are no tanks in the streets. And I bet you if we were in your country, there'd be tanks in the streets." And a lot of them had to admit that there might be. Anyway, I'm encouraged to see what's happening in Iraq, but we're not home yet. We'll have to see what develops in the next year and a half.
It's fascinating that you personally were involved in so many of these things. I still remember the night after the meeting with Tariq Aziz. But you entered the White House at the tail end of the Iran hostage situation in 1980. 30 years later, we have Iran. A lot of those vestiges of those days are with us. They're in the middle between Iraq and Afghanistan. What kind of role? I mean, what's the policy we should be following towards Iran?
I think President Obama has it right. I really support what he's doing with respect to Iran. I think that you ought to have a number of elements to your policy, and they're not mutually exclusive. It gets tiresome to me to hear people say, "Well, we shouldn't be talking to them because if you do that, you're not supporting the reformers in the streets." That's not right. George and I both talked to the Soviets for many years. In fact, as a nation, we talked to them for 40 years. And we still supported the reformers in the streets. And every time we would go to the Soviet Union, we would agitate for and were successful in achieving the release of Soviet Jewry to come to Israel or the United States. So there's no reason why, if you know what you're doing, you shouldn't talk to people. You talk to your friends, sure, but it's your enemies that you ought to worry about talking to. You make peace with your enemies. You don't negotiate peace with your friends. So I support the idea of talking to Iran. He hadn't done any good with it. That just shows you the hard-line nature of that regime. But I think the president's doing the right thing. I think we need to support the reformers in the streets, even to the extent of maybe getting some Farsi broadcasts going in there, the way we used to do with the dissidents in Eastern Europe. I think we need to continue to see if we can negotiate something on the nuclear issue with the Iranians, but keep working for sanctions in the UN Security Council if they're not willing to talk. They're not willing to do anything about their nuclear ambitions. And having said all that, I have no illusions. I think Iran is an extraordinarily large force for instability in that part of the world and in the world generally. I don't happen to think there's a military solution to this problem. As a matter of fact, the Israelis came to the Bush administration, administration of Bush 43, and they asked for overflight rights, and they asked for in-flight refueling capabilities and bunker-busting bombs and deconfliction codes so that they might at some time hit the Iranian nuclear facilities. And the president said, "No, we're not going to do that. That's not where our national interest lies." And I'm not at all sure that even the United States can deal with it militarily. We might be able to, but I don't think I think it's going to be extremely difficult for the Israelis to do that. And lastly, I would argue that we ought not to give up on deterrence. Some people say, well, the minute you talk about deterring Iran, you're acknowledging the fact they're going to get the bomb. Maybe, but look, we deterred the Soviet Union for 40 years, and they had a hell of a nuclear capability, enough to blow everybody off the face of the earth anytime they wanted to. And we were successful in deterring them. So I think I'd pick up the phone and quietly call the head Ayatollah and say, listen, we've got all this unused strategic nuclear capability here, 3,500 nuclear warheads. We don't need them anymore for Russia and Soviet Union. And it takes 20 seconds to re-aim them on you. And by the way, they've just been re-aimed on you. And if you even blink, so much as blink at Israel or at Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Jordan or the Gulf States or the United States, it will be a bad thing for you. Now, they may be flaky, but I think they have a strong interest in self-preservation.
I have to follow up. Have you ever had that conversation with another head of state or foreign minister? No comment. Okay. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is James A. Baker III, former U.S. Secretary of State under the first President Bush, and we are discussing the direction of U.S. foreign policy. Earlier in your remarks, you mentioned the media, the confrontational media. It's not simply the media. We're living in a world today of complete revolution in information and technology and the speed of information and communications.
Yep.
It's a different level for almost between a 10 and a 15-year-old to a 15 and 20-year-old. Looking at the future, how do you see decision-making influenced by that when information is so instant? And what is the trend you see in terms of the view of American youth looking at the future in the whole sense of who we are as a country, patriotism, values that you both grew up during World War II, and you were in the Marines, you are a Marine. Looking to the future, do you see it, how do you deal with that in terms of future generations?
Well, the only way I can answer that is to say I'm as bullish on America as I indicated in my formal remarks. I mean, I think this country is the greatest experiment that's ever come down the pike, and there's no reason if we do what we have to do vis-a-vis our fiscal problems, our economic problems, and our political dysfunction, no reason why we can't continue to be. And I'm very bullish on the future and on our country. The technological revolution has changed the way you do business in Washington, I'll tell you that. When I used to run campaigns, we would look at the network news every evening to determine what the stories were going to be, and we would try and make our impact on the, if we could get 20 seconds, 30 seconds of our campaign on the network news, that was the big deal. And that's how voter intentions were swayed. That's how the voters were swayed. Today, that's not the case. And I mentioned the blogs. I think the blogs can be very, very destructive because people can put whatever the heck they want to there without any tip of the hat to the truth. They throw it in there, and then it gets out there in the ether, and it gets repeated, and you have all these conspiratorial rumors today that are floating around out there. So I'm not sure that's a very good thing, but I do think that the additional media sources is good. The ability to go direct to the American people was something that I think Ronald Reagan did the best job of any of the presidents I worked for. I worked for Ford, Reagan, Bush 1 and Bush 2, and Ronald Reagan really could talk to the American people.
If in your long career, and you've probably been asked this question before, but I'll throw you a softball. If you look in hindsight back at the key decisions you've been involved in, is there anything you think you might have done differently now or that you questioned or challenged yourself on but made a decision now that you wonder if it was the correct one?
Well, yeah, I think there's some that we made that were not correct. I probably wouldn't have chewed the German Bundesbank out on October 18, 1987, just before the market crashed on October 19, 1987, when I was Treasury Secretary. And I might not have, I don't know, we didn't, I don't, we handled the first Gulf War pretty adroitly, I think. At the end, we didn't do the right thing. We should have brought Saddam Hussein himself into the surrender tent at Safwan and made him sign the surrender documents. And we should have told him, no, he couldn't fly his helicopters to reposition his troops. But we were killing a lot of Iraqi soldiers fleeing that battlefield. And I think President Bush did the right thing to stop the war when he did. And I think maybe we should have not deferred to the Europeans with respect to the former Yugoslavia. Remember, we had fought two wars, one in Panama and one in the Gulf. We'd done the Middle East a peace conference. We'd unified Germany in peace and freedom, and we'd presided over the end of the Cold War, all in 3 years. And then when Yugoslavia started breaking up, the European community at that time, it was called, came to us and said, we want the lead in this. We want to take the lead. And we said, have at it. Be our guest. And they went off like they historically have done, like a covey of quail, and they all went for different Yugoslav states. And that was a mistake on our part. We should have said, no, we're gonna stay in there and deal with that too, or try to deal with it. But we had issue fatigue at that time.
I'm going to try and end here with a couple of questions about you, really. And as a young man, did you have a vision of where your life would go, a dream of what you wanted to do? And has that path been one you've actually followed, or?
No. Yeah, I had a vision. I wanted to be a big firm lawyer, and that's what I did for 40 years until I lost my wife, and then I found this second career, which I'm very happy I found. But my vision that when I got out of Princeton and went to the Marine Corps was to get out of the Marine Corps as fast as I could and then be a lawyer. And that's what I did until I was 40 years old. And then things changed, as I mentioned.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only time for one last question, which you can stretch out a little bit. But I wanted to ask you another question about, you know, in terms of leadership, because the journey of your life has obviously led to tremendous decision-making. You've been involved in some of the most historic events of the last 30, 40 years. And what are the things you can tell us about the key values you think the best leaders have and what you've employed yourself?
I think the best thing on leadership is to understand that it's not the private preserve of just a few very talented individuals. If you read that second book of mine, you'll see that my dad taught me something that's very simple, a very simple little axiom, and it's that prior preparation prevents poor performance. He called it the five P's. So I think if you make sure you don't go out and wing it, make sure you prepare yourself, that leadership is not the private preserve of just a few very talented individuals. James McGregor Burns, the historian, said, you know, leadership is knowing what to do and then doing it. And that's the best definition I can think of leadership. I'm probably the only Treasury Secretary in the history of the country that never took a course in economics. George is an economics professor. I'm embarrassed to be even standing up here with him talking about economics things. And I sure didn't take any foreign policy courses in college. And I hadn't been, and I was apolitical for the first 40 years of my life. And I ended up running 5 presidential campaigns. So it's not a case of special, anything special. I think it's just working hard, getting up a little earlier in the morning and staying up maybe a little later at night.
And what do you think was the most influential thing? You mentioned your wife that really, in terms of a leader, influenced you in terms of how you made decisions personally.
What
is the thing that, besides you mentioned the loss of your wife, but as a leader, what factor or value did you really hold in how you made decisions personally?
Well, I'm one who thinks that pragmatism is not a dirty word. Now, sometimes in my party, people are called pragmatists, but I think one of my great mentors, and George's too, Ronald Reagan, was a great pragmatist. Everybody said, oh, he's a real arch conservative. He's way over on the right. That's not true. I can't tell you how many times Ronald Reagan, we'd be alone in the Oval Office, and he would tell me, we'd be talking about what position we're going to take on a piece of legislation or something, he'd say, Jim, I want to tell you, I'd rather get 80% of what I want than go off the cliff with my flag flying. And he was a damn good negotiator. He knew when to hold them and when to fold them. So I think pragmatism is a trait that uh, that leads to success and therefore is something to be admired.
Our thanks to James A. Baker III, former U.S. Secretary of State. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been part of the Club's Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability. I'm Robert Rosenthal, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place we are in to know, is adjourned.